The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
Enda McGrattan is with me now. People will know Enda as co-host of the Paz Vibes podcast. Better known maybe in some circles as Veda.
That's correct. Affair.
So I wanted to ask you about, well, first of all, how would you describe your relationship to Veda?
Wow, that's a good question. I think Veda is like the avatar that I use to empower myself, getting from being a depressed queer teenager in the 80s during the AIDS pandemic in very Catholic Ireland before Sinead O'Connor ripped up a picture of the Pope. Getting from there to who I am now, Veda really helped me just to find my identity and my voice. And I was very withdrawn and quite shy, and Veda just gave me access to a whole other side of my personality that I didn't know was there.
And like at the time, is there a point in time you say I'm going to create this kind of this outlet, or does it just develop slowly? Does it just start with the kind of I'm wearing my sister's clothes and this is a bit of fun, and does it just evolve from that, or how does it?
I did wear my sister's clothes, especially the Debs dresses. I loved the Debs dress.
Oh, did you? Yeah.
But
this is the 80s. So what, were they kind of Love Boat-ish kind of?
There was some big kind of like, think Sharon Hoey was the designer of the day, you know, kind of boxy looking 80s stuff.
Okay, yes.
But what happened with me was I went to San Francisco with no intention of becoming a drag queen and went to my first ever, I would say, avant-garde drag show. I had never seen drag like that before. I'd seen drag before. I used to work in Mr. Pussy's Cafe Deluxe that Bono and Gavin Friday owned on Suffolk Street.
Mm.
And I loved the queens who performed there. But the drag in San Francisco was much more progressive and maybe a little bit more creative. And I didn't know drag like that existed. So once I saw it, it was like an epiphany. And I was like, oh, wow, I'm a drag queen. I just didn't know I was a drag queen.
And then, like, the character itself then, say the character of Veda or anybody else's character, to what extent are they a character in the three-dimensional way? Like, is there like a, do you develop, like, is there backstory? Is there everything?
I think at the start I had a backstory which was about being a Jedi princess, you know, on the run.
Oh, yeah.
But no, not really like that. I think your drag character is just another side of your own personality, in my opinion. Just another part of who you are. And normally people access drag as an art form to empower themselves or to express something that they're struggling to get out. And I think I've been in drag so long, there's no clear borders between Veda and Enda anymore. We're just one entity, you know. I started my show in the George in 1999 on Wednesday nights, and I did it last night. You know, I've been doing it for all of my adult life. And so there is no Veda or Enda anymore. There's just me. And I'd say her backstory now is about being a drag mother and having, you know, so many amazing young drag queens on the scene here in Dublin who look up to me. I don't know why. I guess they don't want to make the mistakes I made. And also being an activist as well, like working with the community, especially the community of people living with HIV. I consider myself to be a mother of that tribe. And so I guess that's Veda as well. You know, that's both of us, because I can use my platform, my drag, when I'm on stage and I have a microphone to say things about sexual health, about shame, about sex positivity that young people just don't hear enough.
For somebody maybe who was, and I'm asking you maybe to kind of put yourself in the mind of somebody else, it's always difficult, but for somebody today who's maybe kind of dipping their toe into it, into say drag as a performance and everything.
Yeah.
Like you described it was a way of kind of maybe expressing a part of your character or personality that you couldn't in 1980s kind of Catholic Ireland. And that Ireland doesn't really exist to the same extent. So what do you imagine a kind of a young person is getting out of it today? Like is it still that there's a part of the personality they feel they need an alter ego to express?
Possibly. Like, I think we're not in Catholic Ireland anymore, but we haven't really moved that much further forward. We have a stronger far right now than we've ever had before. And we have more transphobia than we've ever had before. And also the health services available to trans people in this country are appalling. We're like one of the richest countries in the world, and we have some of the worst trans healthcare. So I would say we need drag to blur the lines, to be provocative, to be defiant, to say that you can't put us into boxes and tell us who we are. We'll tell you who we are. That's what drag is about. But also I think that's also part of what being trans is about. And they're not the same thing, but they are both weapons in the same battle.
And how kind of live is that battle, or has it become?
It's very live.
Yeah.
I think it couldn't be more alive. You know, we lose people, trans people, to suicide all the time in much higher numbers than we lose any other kind of people. And the life expectancy of the average trans woman is very short, only like less than half of the average life expectancy of any other woman. So the battle is very real.
Mm.
Yeah. And now trans people are being weaponized by politicians all the time. The American election is just the most perfect example. This whole bathroom debate that they're having in the White House at the moment, it's such a weird obsession on something that affects such a small percentage of the community.
Yeah, this actually came up in the show earlier in the week, and we were talking about X or Twitter or whatever you want to call it, and I just made the point. I said, like, you'd swear if you looked at my algorithm that the most burning issue on the planet was kind of trans issues.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's all that anyone talks about.
Yeah.
But in reality, you know, the vast majority of people are not sitting down at the dinner table every night talking about who's using what bathroom.
Yeah, exactly. It is a Wizard of Oz curtain. It is a hoax. It's something that they're doing just to distract you, to polarize people, to make us talk about people's genitals, because we love to talk about people's genitals. And really, like I said, it's such a small community and a vulnerable community. And talk about punching down.
What about, you know, where we've seen, and again, this is kind of in the same space because it's the culture war thing. Drag artists who maybe were doing kind of book readings in libraries and stuff.
Yeah.
And this, again, this kind of huge blowback.
Yeah.
Well, I say huge blowback online.
Yeah.
Which, if you were to interpret as the real world, would make you think again that it's outrageous.
Yes.
But I'd wager most people listening to this are kind of going, sorry, what's this about now?
Yeah, like, you know, there's been a tradition of drag queens reading in libraries to kids in America more so than here. But even over a decade ago, I did a play called Auntie Ben, which was about a drag queen helping to raise his niece, Tracy. And Auntie Ben and Tracy were their own little nuclear family. And we did that play in Educate Together schools, and we did it in Smock Alley for very cool liberal kids whose parents were up for allowing them to see it.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that the magic of drag for kids is just like going to the panto. Kids don't care, you know, about your genitals or what bathroom you use. They might care about your tiara or, you know, what football team you support.
Yeah.
And that's what they care about. And I think they're enchanted by drag. But I'm not the kind of drag queen who wants to read story time books to kids.
Yeah.
But I have. And when I did, two people turned up to object. They stood outside. They were shamed away by the parents, run off. And that was it. But I have to say, the parents who bring their kids to those things are not to be messed with. You don't mess with Daddy's little princess.
So, but to what extent do you see, like, so you'd cut two people turning up outside the library? I guess that's suddenly real. You know what I mean? Now they get shamed away and they disappear, they scuttle off. But I guess it does show that you can't entirely dismiss the internet kind of rage, because it empowers people in the real world to think, you know, I'm going to do something about this. I'm going to go down there and I'm going to kind of scream something at abusive in Denda's face.
Yeah, exactly. But you also can't allow that to stop you from being defiant in any way, you know, if you're going to be authentic and really be involved with your community. So it was an awful experience to have people speaking to me like that, but not something that I couldn't handle or I haven't experienced before.
Mm.
And I just wouldn't want to give them that power over me to let anybody think that that's going to make us stop having an event like that. And when you think about it, it's a very small number of two grumpy, geeky people. So if we spend all our time not doing the things that we want to do to make our society more inclusive, in case two grumpy anorak people turn up outside, we're just like giving up, you know, giving up the ghost.
You mentioned kind of the far right as well, and that the increase in kind of that group, or how loud that group has gotten, and this desire they have to kind of bring us back in time to a degree in Ireland. And, you know, when conversations have been had about on the radio, we talk about it maybe in a political sense or in the context of migrants, because that's who they've kind of coalesced around that issue. But just for somebody like yourself as well, for whom the Ireland that existed back in time was an awful lot less hospitable than the Ireland of today, despite its problems. I mean, how do you think when you see those people talking about, you know, Catholic conservative Ireland that we should go back to. What does that mean to you?
Well, firstly, I don't believe for one minute that that the society that I was part of in my childhood and teens would be so openly racist and disrespectful to other people just because they feel entitled to. It's not how it went down. Even if people held racist beliefs, they kept them to themselves and they spoke about them, you know, behind closed doors. That doesn't make it right, but it does make it better. What I'm disgusted at is the sense of privilege that these people think that they have to speak so poorly about other people who they don't even know based on the color of their skin or what country they're migrating from. And yeah, I really hope it'll go away. Cade Mille Fáilte is long a thing of the past now. I work often with asylum seekers, especially queer asylum seekers, and what they go through, the suffering they go through, is horrible. And I worry about some of them giving up and going back home, even though they wouldn't be safe, even more unsafe now. But it's so inhospitable here, like you say. How can they stay? How can their mental health survive that? There isn't even proper services for them. There's nothing for them to do during the day. You know, it takes forever to get a work permit. It takes forever to get a bank account. And then maybe they get involved in antisocial behavior just because they've got no money and nothing to do. Or maybe their mental health just gets so bad that they have a much harder time finding their feet, getting a job, contributing to society. We're setting people up to fail. And that is the problem with having a far right at all.
It's like the way you speak about it there, and you know, the way you speak about describing yourself as kind of the mother of the tribe as well when it comes to HIV. Like this kind of role as a representative or kind of speaking up for people who are feeling oppressed or downtrodden or discriminated against, that is still something that it quite obviously still motivates you.
Absolutely. I struggled as a queer kid. I was bullied a lot. I struggled as a queer teen. And growing up at that time with HIV/AIDS, people would tell you blatantly to your face that you're going to die of AIDS before you've ever even had sex, or that you're going to die alone. It's a really weird relationship that you have then with your sexuality. Mm. And then when I got a HIV diagnosis, I spent 10 years in the closet feeling unlucky, unlovable, shameful because of a virus, which now seems laughable to me. It seems so ridiculous. And when you come through something like that, all you want to do is let other people in that position know that there is absolutely no reason for them to live that way.
Yeah.
Absolutely none. It's my passionate mission in life to end HIV stigma.
I don't know how it came up. We were talking about ER or something. It was an anniversary earlier this year. Was it 30 years since ER? I think it was 30 years since it came out. And actually, I went back and started watching it on the Channel 4 player. And it's amazing that you can kind of get a sense of what was in the zeitgeist at the time. So in the first season, there's like four different AIDS storylines.
Wow.
Which, you know, a hospital drama today wouldn't in one season have that four times, you know, because that was swirling around. I just thought that was really, by the time the kind of third or fourth one came along, I was like, this is really interesting.
And it would be amazing if a hospital drama now would have four different HIV storylines, because that would be amazing. Because our storylines would be, I take one pill a day, I can't pass it on to my partner, I come in here, you know, every 4 months for a blood test. I'm best friends with
my
HIV doctor.
They don't do it because it's thankfully boring.
Exactly, exactly. But it'd be great for people to put that message out with the same kind of like passion that they want to spread the sadness and the stigma. There's this thirst for trauma in the media. You know?
But why does the stigma still exist then? You know, if, like I say, they wouldn't do that storyline, there'd be a sense, well, that's kind of, we've solved that problem to a degree. Let's move on. But the stigma does exist.
The stigma still exists because nobody has put in the work to destroy the stigma. That's as simple as that. The gatekeeping in the HIV industry is unbelievable. You know, people who have the resources are not putting them to work to destroy stigma. And then people who don't have the resources, activists like us, do that work.
And meanwhile, who are those gatekeepers, you mean?
Oh my God, I couldn't name them.
No, but I mean, like it gives...
They are...
In an abstract sense, gives a sense of who you're...
providers.
Okay, okay.
For the HIV positive community.
Okay.
Yeah. And I would do inverted commas with my fingers, but We're on the radio.
People can imagine the air quotes.
Uh-huh. And, you know, and there's just not much happening with all of those resources and all of that money, to be honest. Yeah. You can go online and look. Look for the campaigns. Look for the output. Show me. We have about 12 grand a year, Robbie and I, Pause Vibe Tribe, to do what we do. And if you look on our social media for our output in 1 year, it will baffle you, I promise you, because we work hard because we love hard.
Yeah.
You go and look at some of these other NGOs and what they do, and we're not even a charity. We're private individuals. Look for the output. That's what I would say. Show me the money, honey.
Well, you mentioned Robbie. Listen, I had a great chat with Robbie when he was in, and I really enjoyed this as well, Enda.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it too.
Yeah, thanks a million. So, Enda McGrattan, co-host, you mentioned it there, I mentioned it earlier, the Pause Vibes podcast.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.